I want to tonight continue, as I said I was going to do Sunday, with the subject of providence. We're going to look at this for the next 2 or 3 weeks. We'll see how far that goes. But this is something people are obviously very interested in because I have more reaction to last Sunday's sermon than usual. In fact, significantly more. More comments, more discussion, more... I don't have a Facebook, but I've heard Facebook comments, so I guess I'm moving up if we're getting some Facebook comments going out there. But that tweets, who knows? You know, John Piper called me, told me it was a good message too, but no, just kidding. He doesn't know me. But this is a big deal. This is a big subject, and especially as we look into the whole 2013, into the whole rest of the year. What a great thing to have our minds focused on, you know, for the whole year. And I want to kind of just rehearse with you just a second the definition I gave you for providence. There are multiple variations of this definition, depending on who you read. All of them are similar, we hope. And this is mine, okay? This is my boiling it down. And I boil it down to this. Say it with me, if you would. God's care, concern, discipline, involvement, and direction in your life for His purpose. That's really, in my mind, what it's all about. And as I said, we had a lot of reaction. Why would that be? Why, I mean, think about it just for a minute. Why would there be reaction? Why would there be encouragement? Why would there be questions? Why would there be all of this? And I think this, the answer is because we're very interested to know that God is at work in reality in our lives and in the world, that He's in charge, that He's doing something. We want to know that. We want to see that. And when we do, it's very encouraging. Now, when you start talking providence, it means that God is coming into your space, so to speak, and He's working in you and around you, and occasionally you get to see it. That's what I said Sunday, and I believe that's true. So part of this series is going to be telling stories. And what would be really neat is if you shared your stories too. I'd asked for that a while back, and Agnes gave me a great description of what God was doing in her life. I didn't get a lot of response on that, but maybe now that we're talking about it, you know, some of you bang out some stuff where you've seen God at work, you know, where you've seen the providence of God in the smiling providences, and then also in the difficult times where you've seen the providence of God. Speaking of providence, this happened tonight, okay? I had my notebook out, and that's my Wednesday night notebook, and I was going over my notes. I hadn't paid attention to what was in the flyleaf. And in the flyleaf, right next to the point where I asked the question, why are we interested in this, there is this piece of paper that I had put here months ago, and it's a letter that I was going to use, or maybe I used it in a Bible study or something, and I said, what is this? And I started reading it, and it's from my aunt. It's a copy of a note from my aunt to me about a conversation she'd had with her sister, who's my mother. And listen to this. This answers the question, or at least shows why we need to be talking about the providence of God. Dear Mark, oh, by the way, something difficult had happened in her life. A friend of hers got a bad, really bad medical report, and she was reeling from it, and my Aunt Janet is a Christian, and this is what she said. I tried to encourage her after I'd gotten the news, and she said, Dear Mark, thank you for your words of encouragement. After last night and this morning, I was in such a state of negativism that I had failed to remember that God is always in charge. I read that 45 minutes ago before I came here tonight, and I was like, well, that's it. That's the issue. And because this happens in our lives, because when we get in a state of discouragement or bad news or difficult chain of events in our lives, sometimes because we forget that God is in charge, that He is providential in our lives, it throws us into a state of negativism and discouragement. She's just confessing that. And then she goes on to say that after speaking with Dee, my mother, this morning, she helped me to calm down and help my frustrations. I spoke with a friend, and then I was able to share with her. She goes on to tell about how she was able to share what Mom had told her, and she was back on track, and things were going good because she had gotten encouragement. But that's why we need to talk about providence, because our tendency is that when we get in difficult circumstances is to forget. I'm going to read it again. I failed to remember that God is always in charge. What was the result of that? Negativism, discouragement, difficulty in her feelings. Now, what's really cool about that is that that was literally, I don't want to be too much of a mystic here and, you know, and trying to invent stuff, but folks, it is literally on the same line as when I asked the question, why are we interested to know that God is at work in reality around us? And I saw it, I said, that was providential. Let's just get used to saying that. You see something happen in your life that's working out. The details are unusually working out. You say, well, that was providential. And so, there it is again in our lives. You know, people even in the world, I've heard people say this, you probably have too, when you're talking with them, they're not even necessarily a Christian. You don't even know necessarily if they believe in God or they're committed to the idea of God, and something happens, and they say this, well, everything happens for a reason. You ever heard anybody say that? Who's not even necessarily religious. Oh, everything happens for a reason. Now, not everybody thinks that consciously, but a lot of people do, interestingly, irrespective of their faith in God. Why? Because eternity in the heart of a person basically communicates the rationality and the reasonableness of the fact that everything happens for a reason. Now, as Christians, we just know why and who. And occasionally, we get to see what? How. So, providence is very important to us. It's kind of understood even among those who have no definable faith, but we have a definition for it. So, tonight, I want to capitalize, if you will, on the interest that we've experienced on this and encourage you further about the reality of the providence of God. And then, as we go along, I want to get into some of the specifics of how that ends up working out in our lives and some of the big questions that are going to come up when it comes to that. I mean, if God is always at work and always in charge and there's a reason for everything, you know, why does it matter what I do? You know, you say, well, haven't you talked about that before? Yeah, and I'm going to keep talking about it probably as long as I have a ministry, because that's one of the big questions of our lives. Well, what's the balance between, where do I fit into that? Am I even responsible for anything if God is providentially working? And of course, the answer is yes, but we will look at it. Keep this in mind. I want to make a distinction later about the difference, or the distinction, if I will, not the difference, the distinction between sovereignty, the sovereignty of God, and the providence of God. They're not in any way opposing, they're parallel ideas, but there is a distinction between the two. We talk a lot about sovereignty at our church, that God is in charge. He can rule and over his universe. Providence more brings it closer to us. Providence takes the sovereignty of God and makes it personal. Providence shows us that God is not just has authority to do whatever he wants. He does do whatever he wants, and he has a purpose and a loving, kind, beneficial attitude towards his creation, specifically his people, as he exerts and has his sovereignty. So there is a distinction, and I want us to look at that as we go along. And so we'll get into some of the specifics of how it works out in our life, why it matters, because I actually want to encourage you in your faith, in your trust factor, because that is what this whole thing of providence is really about. So, stories of providence. We have lots of them, so let's get used to telling those stories and telling them to each other. I want to tell you a little story about a $50 gate key, all right? Now, the reason I put the picture up here is so you get the idea of what's happening here. You notice this is down at Mom and Dad's house down in Key Largo. That their house is on the right, and they're right in front of this little community park. It's a subdivision park. And do you see past Glory and Jonathan there, the gate? Can you all make that out back there? See the gate? Well, on the gate, there is a little chain with a big padlock that stays. You can't remove the lock from the gate, and it goes, and you're supposed to keep it locked because it's a private park. If we don't, it'll just become a public park, and then it'd be trashed. And so when you pay your dues for the park, you get your key. And my dad is fond of reminding us that that key, if lost, costs $50. So we don't lose the key. It's on a big red thing he made for it with a big tag on it to make it kind of hard to lose, you know. And Dad is the gate key keeper. You don't not put the key away when you're done. We've heard many lectures about the gate key. And so we're all a little afraid of the gate key. And that's a positive thing because it keeps us from losing it. But Dad's just a stickler about it. You know, he's pleasant about it most of the time. And he, you know, but when the family's down there, and we were just down there for Christmas, between Christmas and New Year's, and we had 15 people there in that little house, you know, and lots of kids and lots of, I mean, that gate, we are going in and out of that gate when we're down there, going down to the dock, going down to the beach, going down to the little park, going down the Ripstick on the, you know, whatever. And so it's getting used a lot. And I can just hear my father saying, "Where is the key? Who didn't put back the key?" Because it goes right by the door. Well, we couldn't find the key. And that's bad. So we're all looking for the key. Can't find the key. Everybody's asking who's got the key. Last I heard, it was with Andrew. Last time, it was with Jonathan. Last time, you know, who's got the key? Well, it was coming down to the fact that my brother, Andrew, we call him Big Andrew because my nephew Kelly's son's also Andrew, he had brought the boat out of the ramp, and it was boiling down to this. It was between Big Andrew and Jonathan. And Big Andrew was saying, "Jonathan, I remember taking the key and flinging it to you, and you said you were going to get the gate." Jonathan said, and who's an honest kid, said, "I have no recollection of that. No, I remember. I remember giving you the key." And this little standoff, you know, with smiles and fun, you know, nobody gets mad about this, but it was, you know, kind of like, "Nope, I don't have any recollection of that." And that went back and forth and back and forth. Well, this went on for about, I don't know, 5 hours. You know, everybody looking for the key, you know, coming and going and doing other things. But you know, where's the key? Did you look here? Did you? Everybody check their pockets, you know. So I came back up into the house, and my dad came through the back door. "I found the key." And everybody said, "Where was it?" "It was in little Andrew's coat pocket, in his jacket pocket. I went around and checked all the coat pockets I could find on the property, and I found it. I knew somebody had it in their coat pocket." Andrew said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." Well, Big Andrew wasn't there. So we were all there in the house, and I said, "I got an idea. Let's put the key in Big Andrew's coat pocket that's downstairs by the bed." And everybody said, "Great idea." So that's what we did. And as I did Sunday, I'll tell you what happened at the end of the message tonight. Okay? God's care, concern, discipline, involvement, and direction in your life for His purpose. We looked at two scriptures Sunday. Let me remind you of them. Very common, but important. Romans 8:28. "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to His purpose." You know, I feel kind of bad anytime I read that verse because we're so familiar with it that I say it kind of quickly because I know we're all familiar with it. And it's almost like, you know, it's like be careful with that verse. It's fragile. Don't do anything to minimize it. Don't do anything to take away from it. And so I want you all to have that attitude about this verse, because what a terrible thing to become inoculated with some of the key scriptures to the point that you get a little bit of the real thing to keep you from getting the ultimate real thing. That's what an inoculation does. You don't want to be inoculated with Romans 8:28. You want to get it. and you don't want to keep from getting it. So as I was thinking about this verse, Mark and Craig and I were having a meeting yesterday, and we got to talking about it. And one of the things I want to do on here is kind of give you some, as we come through some of this stuff, I want to like branch out a little bit, make a point, and then come back to the whole point. And that's, this is something we observed about this verse that I want you to even take a note on if you're taking notes. When we think about this verse, do you usually think of it in the terms of something difficult and negative happening in your life or something good and positive happening in your life? Let me ask you. Tell me. Huh? Okay, somebody said both. Where you tend to see it? Negatively, right? That's just natural. Most of us are going to see it negatively. We think, well, this difficult thing happened, but hey, you know, God causes all things to work together for good. And that certainly is true, and that's half the story. In fact, with that in mind, I went back and looked at Romans 8, and there is discussion about suffering. There's discussion about persecution. All the terrible things that we might feel like are pulling us away from God, to know that at the end of that chapter, it says nothing is ever going to be able to pull us away from God. So even in Paul's life, there was a lot of difficulty. But the verse doesn't say God causes all bad things to work together for good. What does it say? It says, look at it carefully, God causes all things. Sometimes you just need to put a pause at the end of certain words to get a new understanding of it. It's kind of like, you know, in the documents of the founding fathers, you know, all men are created equal. Well, you can put a pause after created. That's what my pastor used to do. All men are created. Oh, equal. God causes all things. God causes all things to work together for good. It doesn't say God causes only the bad things to work together for good. No, the point is that God is providentially in control, governing the affairs of people. And so he causes all things to work together for good, and especially to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. So, when we see a providential verse like this, be careful with it that you don't put it always in one camp and then you get up in a rut of thinking about it. It's true that God causes all difficult things in our lives to work together for good. You got to believe that. That will help you. And since we live in a fallen world, a sinful world, and we're sinners and we make foolish decisions and we ignorantly do things and we live in a fallen world that gets inflicted on us at times, praise God. He's in charge, and it's all going to work together because he, why? Because he's working all things together. But it's also true of, you know, let's say the college student who's young in their life, and, you know, they got so much to look forward to, and they're doing well in school, and they're thinking about the future, and they've just met the love of their life, and they're, you know, it just seems like, man, everything is just moving in the right direction. The picture's starting to come into clarity. And what is that person supposed to do? Just feel guilty that things are working out? No, he's going to go to Romans 8, she's going to go to Romans 8, 28 and claim the same truth. Why? Because there is a providential God who is concerned and who is working and who is working for the good and the beneficial nature of this person's life, and that is true for them too, just as it is for the person who is at the hospital grieving over somebody who's just discovered they have cancer. So, the way we look at this is not just that all difficult things work together for good. Don't miss the reality of what allows all that to happen. What is it? God causes all things to work together. Period. That's what he does. So learn from that to take a passage of Scripture or a verse of Scripture, to meditate on it long enough for you to be able to glean from it the amazing. There was a professor at Dallas Seminary that in his hermeneutics class, he would tell us that's interpretation, a class of interpretation, learning how to interpret Scripture, and how to make observations in a text. He told his students, he went to Acts 1:8, which was the verse he would always use, And he said, actually, by the way, it was Howard Hendricks, for those of you who remember Howard Hendricks. He would tell them, I want you to go home and find 25 observations about this verse. And a friend of mine who went to school there said, boy, that was tough. I mean, I sat there and worked to make 25 legitimate observations about Acts 1:8. And he said, I worked at it and worked at it and finally got my 25 and came to class. And Dr. Hendricks told everybody, okay, I want you to go home and find 25 more things of significant observations about this verse. Be careful with Romans 8:28 that you don't lose sight of the wealth and the depth and the power and the profundity that is in the idea that God causes all things, everything in your life to work together for good. There are no exceptions if you love God. So, Romans 8:28 is huge to us. Ephesians 1:11, we said this Sunday, also we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined, God looking forward and determining what is going to happen in the future. It's in the Bible. You can't get away from it. Enjoy it and be amazed by it. Having been predestined according to His purpose, who works all things, there it is again, after the counsel of His will. Nobody else can say that. Nobody. Nobody has that kind of power. Nobody has that kind of wisdom. Nobody has that kind of will to be able to determine all things according to the purpose of their own will. That's a huge verse. When that begins to become part of your thinking, it will begin to work its way out in the joyful, blissful, productive times in your life and the difficult times in your life. I mentioned George Washington Sunday, and I had providentially, I guess, lost my piece of paper, which I still to this hour don't know what happened to it. But of course, now I could go back and find the information. And I want to tell you a little bit more about this George Washington, who we all know as the first president. And I think a lot of people, about the only thing they know about George Washington is he was the first president and he chopped down a cherry tree. Unfortunately, our knowledge is lacking. But providence was very important to George Washington. He used the word a lot. And I did a little digging around and I'd known that providence was a word that a lot of the founding fathers of our country used. And providence, as it turns out, is George Washington's preferred, or was George Washington's preferred term to describe the God of the Bible as Jehovah, as God's sovereign will in the history of mankind. Of course, they were making history. They were watching it happen. I think they were even aware that they were doing that. Thomas Jefferson even recognized and John Adams recognized that in the future there would be amazing and tremendous celebration that would come on the celebration of the Declaration of Independence. But George Washington's definition of providence, one writer said, was clearly discernible in many of the letters that he wrote to people. Over 270 references to providence and providential as well documented in a book called Sacred Fire, which was written by Peter Lilback and Jerry Newcomb. Jerry, you know, is one of the employees at Coleridge Ministries, where John Rabe works. And this book, a huge book, like 580 pages, came out about really showing the true spirituality and Christianity of George Washington. And the person who was writing about this, Peter Lilback or Jerry Newcomb, said that according to Washington, providence is God's invisible superintending or overruling of human events. Now, I would disagree with that a little bit because he used the word invisible. I don't believe it's always invisible. In fact, as we said Sunday, one of the great things about knowing God is that occasionally God's providence comes into the visual realm. You get to see it. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. As long as we're not inventing it, and we're not embellishing it or trying to make God look better, you know, because the story gets more dramatic or something. And people do tend to do that. You have to be careful with that. But if we just take what actually happens and look into what it was, we do get to see it. And this is the glory of God. There's nothing wrong with that. What did Moses want to see? He wanted to see the glory of God. You know, is the psalm writers are referring back to the great things that God has done, and they want to see it again. And so it's not really invisible, but there is that superintending issue. But Washington so believed in the doctrine of providence, as one letter indicates, that he even considered apparently becoming a preacher. In a letter that he wrote to Brigadier General Thomas Nelson on August 20th, 1778, check this out. Oh, that's the definition I already talked about, but we'll skip that. Let me read this part of the letter to you. "Is it not a little pleasing," he says, "nor less wonderful to contemplate that after 2 years of maneuvering and undergoing the strangest of vicissitudes," how many of you know what vicissitudes mean? Huh? Vicissitudes, excuse me. Can anybody give me a definition of vicissitude? I'll tell you what, I'll give a dollar to whoever can give me an accurate definition of vicissitude. Start with Anyas. Huh? Difficulties, that's part of it.
Variety.
Suffering. The definition relates to difficulties that come with the change of events. Changes of events that are of a difficult nature. Okay? Changes of events. Variety of events. Okay? So you said variety. You said, no. We'll give it to the lady. Okay? Oh, just playing. I kind of want to make an issue out of that word, because are we not stopped in our tracks many times by the unpleasant change of events? Isn't that really where we live? I mean, your life is going along and you have expectations and you think things are going to be a certain way. And then there's a change of events. And if it's not pleasant, now we've got a decision to make. Now we have to rely on something inside of our psychology, inside of our memory, inside of our belief system. There's something going to dictate how we respond when the unpleasant change of events come. So vicissitudes that happen in our life that George Washington mentions are real. So what does he say? "The strangest of vicissitudes that perhaps ever attended any one contest since the creation of both armies, England, America, are brought back to the very point they set out from. And that which was the offending party in the beginning is now reduced to use the spade and the pickaxe for defense. The hand of providence has been so conspicuous in all this that he must be worse than an infidel that lacks faith, and more than wicked that has not gratitude enough to acknowledge his obligations. But it will be time enough for me to turn preacher when my present appointment ceases, and therefore I shall add no more to the doctrine of providence." That's the first president of our country. He believed that God was behind what was happening in that war and in his life. And he even goes so far as to say, you know, if people don't recognize that, it's not just, well, you know, to each his own. He saw it as a moral issue. And so, the combination of George Washington's character and his formed biblical opinions that came really from the homeschooling, if you will, of his mother. And if you think about the context that he was living in, what an amazing time to be watching the conspicuous providences of God, even the miraculous events in his own life that preserved his life. All of this built up and confirmed his view of the world. And as one person said, that view was the God of the Bible, was that the God of the Bible was working his sovereign will in his own life, and through the events of the Revolutionary War, which empowered godly men and women to self-govern. And instead of having, listen to this, instead of having to say all of this in one long sentence every time he talked about it, he wished to convey his thinking. How could he do it? He could say it all in one word. What was the word? Providence. Providence, listen to this. Write this down. Providence was the lens which George Washington understood the world. Providence was the lens with which George Washington understood the world. So we have a good heritage when it comes to this. By the way, I wonder in the providence of God, and I don't know if there's any way to know this out this side of heaven, but how much of the fact that 250 years ago, how much, since that was so much part of the founding of our country that we live in today, is the reason why we believe it and we understand it. That it was built into the fabric, even though that is loosening today, how much of God's providence in those men of that time is now the reason why we're even talking about it? God is involved in the affairs of nations even, as we're going to see. I got an email from John Rabe, one of our elders, as a result of last Sunday's message, and I thought it was good. I wanted to share it with you. John sent me this, and it comes kind of, you know, with the understanding that, you know, the accusation of the liberals is that the founding fathers were mostly deists. And deists, you know, were basically just, well, belief in a general God, and he kind of wound up the world, turned it loose, and he's not really involved. He's not really involved in the world. And that most of them were deists. And so the reason they used the word providence many times instead of God was because they were deists, because they would use that word. They used that actually as proof that they weren't really Christians, or they weren't really believers in the God of the Bible, or you know, a creator God that you could know personally. John sent me this this statement that they use it apparently at Coral Ridge quite often. But during the stalemate, John writes this, during the stalemate of the Constitutional Convention, Ben Franklin was not necessarily known to be very religious. In fact, of them, he probably was the most, the least, quote, as we would call religious, maybe a deist. I don't know. I don't know all the history of it, but he certainly would have been called a deist. But during the stalemate of the Constitutional Convention, he rose up to call on the convention to stop for prayer. And this is what he was quoted by James Madison as saying. Listen to this, or read this with me. Not out loud. In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for the divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. To that kind providence, we owe this happy opportunity of consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future national felicity. And have now we forgotten that powerful friend? I have lived, sir, a long time. And the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, obviously quoting Jesus, Is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, the Bible, that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. That's from Psalm 127. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our little partial local interests, our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. And what is worse, mankind may hereafter from this unfortunate instance despair of establishing governments, be human by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, and conquest. And then he says, I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessing on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of the city be requested to officiate in that service. Ben Franklin. Now, as John says, if that's deism, we could use a whole lot more of it. Providence is part of the fabric, belief in providence is part of the fabric of our country, and even, obviously, clearly biblical. Now, I want you to, as we continue to be encouraged in our the reality of providence, that's the purpose of tonight, and as was the purpose last Sunday, I want us to think on another level about how this works out in our lives. Part of the ultimate reason for God's activity in our lives is our recognition of Him. It's not just, He's not playing games. He's got a purpose behind it all. And when we get to see God's activity in our lives, it's supposed to do something to us. It's supposed to lead us somewhere with our view and our thinking. And that is to Him, personally. It's not just for our benefit and for necessarily just us being free of pain or even having just some explanation for it all. It's driving us to Him. It's driving us to God. And anything that does that for us is going to end up being a good thing. And so looking to Him, looking for Him, for what we need, for our satisfaction, all of these things you'll find in the Bible over and over again. And a lot of the Bible is there to help convince us that our source for life, for satisfaction, is in God. And along with that, to help us stop looking for it in other places. You'll find that over and over in the Bible. It's not just God is worthy of trust. It's bigger than that. It's let me show you why God is worthy of trust. Let me show you what's happened in the past. Let me show you what I've already done in your life. And you need to stop looking in other places. One passage calls it hewn out cisterns that leak. You're trying to get a drink out of something that doesn't hold any water. Look to me. And so providentially, I'm going to be at work in your life to cause you to look to me, to impress you to look to me, for you to be wowed by my care and concern in your life and my discipline in your life. What then is the source of this satisfaction? What is this provision? Is it just provision? Is it needs being met alone? No, it's not alone. It is the ultimate satisfaction of being in touch with the God who can do and does do whatever He wants. Let me say that again. Part of our satisfaction in our relationship with God is not just getting our needs met, it's the fact that we are connected to and in touch with a God, with the God. I'm going to use a God and the God together. This God is the one, unlike all the other places that people look or all the other idols that, say, Israel look to, this is the God. What is the thing about Him that should impress us to the point of a satisfaction in this relationship? It's that this God can do whatever He wants, and He does do whatever He wants. That's the connection. I'm making a connection of two ideas that you probably already believe, but I'm not sure you've ever seen them put together. Do we believe that God can do whatever He wants? Absolutely. That's generally what we believe as evangelical, conservative, Bible-believing Christians, okay? We believe God can do whatever He wants. If you say, do you experience and are you connected to, in a personal way, God? We would say yes. We believe that Jesus came to give us a relationship with this God, more than just a belief in Him, but we are at peace with Him through the gospel. We are connected to Him. Now put the two ideas together. You are connected to not just God, it's the God who can do and does do whatever He wants. That is what brings us joy and satisfaction in this relationship. We're not connected to a God who's incapable or who is impoverished or who isn't sovereign. We believe these things and we believe we can be connected, but to put the two together, that's what's going to bring a joy and a satisfaction in your life that God is after. He wants that for you because that ultimately brings him glory and it brings you good. So where do we go in the Bible to really see that? I want to take you to the book of Isaiah, and for the remainder of our time, I'm just going to read the 46th chapter of Isaiah, because I believe, as I've read this, this is probably the most definitive statement about the providence of God, okay? There's many, but as I've read the many different statements and studying for this, I just can't find, at least for me, something that is this poignant, this detailed, this specific about the providence of God. So I really want you to get Psalm 46, okay? And in Isaiah 46. In Isaiah 46, we have God once again laying out the evidence and reasoning for the people of God to look to him over what? The Babylonian gods that they were embracing. You know, they, if you look at the history of Israel and Judah at this time, you know, you've got them, you know, on the edge of captivity and then in the captivity, and they're making deals with the Assyrians, trying to keep peace by not going to war because they knew they'd get whooped. And so, you know, even good kings like Hezekiah, you know, tempted with, you know, making deals and paying money. And then you have the passages in Isaiah where through the prophet, God is saying, what are you doing? Why are you making deals with people who don't know me? Why are you trying to get peace from people who don't know anything about peace? Why are you looking for satisfaction in other gods besides me? And so he's there to reprove them, but not just to reprove them, but to convince them, look to me. And then the history of them is when they did, they won. When they didn't, they lost. And it's not just what God will do for them, for their benefit, that he was calling them. There is an appeal to the fact that God can do and will do whatever he wants. So here's my point. In Psalm 46, when we read this, I don't want you just to read a rebuke to look to God. Why should they look to God? What is it about God that should be so magnificent and magnetizing, drawing them in? What is it about God that should be calling them to say, forget them, forget these idols, forget these pagans, forget all this other stuff that's trying to clamor for my attention? Why should I go after this God? Why? It's in Psalm 46. There's quite a bit of scripture about something being in vain, you know, something chasing after something that doesn't go anywhere, has no purpose, no meaning, just randomness. And worship, in part, is tied to be convinced that there is indeed purpose behind God's creation and what he's doing. Not randomness. You know, randomness leads to all kinds of terrible things. It leads to despair. It leads to abusiveness, by the way. If you think the world is just random and there's no purpose behind it, who cares what I do? I can go hurt anybody I want. So it doesn't, because it doesn't matter. There's no purpose. Godless randomness is very dangerous. And so God is calling them away from that. He wants them to see that there is purpose behind what he does. So now, with that in mind, I want you to look with me at Isaiah 46, okay? I'm going to read the whole chapter, and I want you just to feel it as we read it, okay? I'll make a couple comments along the way. Bel has bowed down. Nebo stoops over. Those are the Babylonian pagan idols that have a name. They were man-made and they had a name. Their images are consigned to the beasts and the cattle. They look like animals. Now God, this is powerful because God's going to mock them, okay? Mock this other pagan idol-worshipping religion. The things that you carry are burdensome. You're lugging around your God. It's heavy. The thing you worship, it's, you know, you're carrying it around. A load for the weary beast. Put it on the back of a cow or on a cart, dragging it around. They stooped over. They have bowed down together. In other words, they fall over. They could not rescue the burden. but have themselves gone into captivity. You take that God, take that idol, you stick it in a box or you put it in a cabinet or put a building over it or something like that. It's in itself in captivity. And then God says through the prophet, listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. You who have been born by me from birth, and I have been carried and have been carried from the womb. Now notice the contrast to the previous verse where he says, you know the other idols? You got to carry them around. Guess what? I carried you. People invented those gods and birthed them. Guess what? I birthed you. Look at the contrast, he says. Even to your old age, I will be the same. And even to your graying years, I will bear you. I'm going to keep carrying you. I have done it. I will carry you, and I will bear you, and I will deliver you. And the contrast is obvious. Something the pagan gods that you're looking to, that you're tempted with, can't do for you. God is always showing the difference between what he can do versus what the things you tend to run to can do. Now, before I even continue reading about idols, you say, you know, what does that have to do with me? I don't have a bar, I don't have a, something I worship in my house, or we don't have a national, you know, pagan thing that we go down to the shrine of the whatever and worship there. No, we don't, but there's plenty of other gods. A god is anything that you set up that you're looking to help you find what only God can give. That's what ends up being an idol in your life. Anything. Anything. We are just as capable of idolatry in 21st century America as they were 1,000 years before Jesus. Lifelong problem. Worldwide problem. Verse 5. To whom would you liken me? I like this. And make me equal and compare me. God is saying to them that we would be alike. Me and something else. I talk to me. And there's other places where God says, let's come, let's reason together. Can I just appeal to your reason, he says. Who are you going to make me like? Come on. To those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh silver on the scale, hire a goldsmith, and he makes it into a god? They bow down, indeed they worship it. You just made it, now you're worshiping it? They lift it up on the shoulder and carry it. They set it in its place, and it stands there. It does not move from its place. Though one may cry to it, it cannot answer. It cannot deliver him from his distress. God is appealing to what their needs were. And what do we always have God saying? Call on me, I'll answer you. Pray. In your distress, cry out to me. He says, you're going to cry out to these things? Because that's what they were doing. It cannot deliver him from his distress. Verse 8, remember this and be assured. Recall it to your mind, you transgressors. In other words, he's saying, I'm forcing you to think about this. Who are you going to liken me to? What is it going to do in your life? When you pray to it and cry to it, it's kind of like the verse 8 there is kind of saying, I want an answer. I'm waiting. I want you to think about it. Don't just pass this off. Who are you likening me to? Who are you comparing me to? What are you looking to? Okay? Now, the part that really deals with our subject is in verse 9. Remember the former things long past. For I am God and there is no other. He goes ahead and answers what they should be concluding. I am God and there is no one like me. Now get this. Declaring the end from the beginning. And from ancient times things which have not been done, saying, read this with me, will you? My purpose will be established. And I will accomplish all my good pleasure. I want you to read that with me again. My purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. I want you to see that in Isaiah 46, the case that God makes for himself of why they should turn from the other things to come back to the Lord, what is his case? It wasn't that, hey, I'm going to make your life better. It wasn't I'm nice. It wasn't I love you, even though I believe he wouldn't have even told them this if he didn't love them. What was he appealing to for their reasons for following him? He was appealing to this reality. I can do what I want, my purposes will be established, and I will accomplish everything I want to accomplish. That was the thing that he wanted in their minds that would cement them into being able to trust him and believe in him, to be satisfied to him, and to leave all the other stuff. That was the point. I can do what I want. I will do what I want. My purposes will be established in the earth, which includes in your life. And that should be the thing that draws you to me. So, to use our word, providence is more than just going, oh, isn't that neat? Isn't that cool how that worked out? I really like how that worked out. No, providence is us being so impressed by a God who can do and does do whatever he wants. He can organize the events of my life and the whole world, and he can make all the variables fit together, and he can be accomplishing 10,000 things all around me, even though I may be only aware of two or three of them. He can do all of that, and that should be something that, oh, just drives me to him to get everything I need in life. So it is the providence of God that is not some optional idea that's just for things or people that are theological in their minds and like to think about these things. This is foundational, faith-building, trust-producing truth. Remember the former things past, for I am God. There is no other. I am God. There is no one like me. Declaring the end from the beginning? Look at verse 11. This is how he finishes it. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country. What is he saying there? He's giving examples. I can do what I want. I will fulfill my purposes, even if it means getting a bird to fly in from the east to do something that I want it to do, or calling a man from a far country to come here and to do something. There's a little bit of overtone there, because we know that Isaiah was the prophet who began to prophesy of what the Messiah would be like, and what the Messiah, how he would suffer. And he began to show that this is not going to be a matter of delivering you from people like Babylon ultimately. It's going to be about delivering you from sin. And the suffering Messiah is going to come and bear the sins of the world. Isaiah 53. I can do what I want. I have spoken. Look at this. I have spoken. Truly, I will bring it to pass. I have planned it. Surely, I will do it. All right, let's read that together. You ready? Calling a bird of prey. I want this with some conviction, okay? Because this is like mega important. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country. Truly I have spoken. Truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it. Surely I will do it. That is who you're trusting in. If you believe that, more you will be able to trust. And I want to encourage you tonight with this basic one simple message. Your Heavenly Father has the bigger picture of life even when you can't see it. That's what He has. Everyone at some point, if not most of the time, wonders why things happen in life and why they don't happen. And the wondering can, you know, be worshipful wondering, but it can also be struggles at our core. God is not being fair. God must be mad at me. God doesn't love me. And our level of struggle will in part be determined by how much we are convinced that there is a bigger picture, that God has a purpose that he's accomplishing more than what we can see, and that God has that picture firmly in his mind, and he's going to and will accomplish everything he has perfectly, his goals, exactly like he wants to do it as it even relates to us. 4 years ago, maybe, 4 or 5 years ago, we went to Disney World. We took the kids for the first time, actually. And Glory was, I think, about 6. And I remembered that the last time I had been at Disney World was at the Night of Joy back 27 years ago, actually, from now. In fact, it was the first time I ever was around Janine. That's where I met Janine, on the bus going to Night of Joy. And so I wasn't really paying attention because it was in the dark and Night of Joy. But 4 years ago or 5 years ago when I was at Disney World, I began to realize and think how small the park was. Now, you know this experience. You know, it seems small because when you were a kid, it seemed so big, right? But it was bigger than that for me. I began to realize this park makes, you know, I see how it works. You know, we had the map. But when I was a child, when we used to go to Disney World, I was never aware of where things were. I mean, you were in this ride or in that ride, and you just kind of assumed your parents knew what they were doing and where they were going. And, you know, Dad had the map. I wasn't even aware of. And I remember 5 years ago going, oh, the Hall of Presidents is in Pioneer Land, I think it's called, or something like that, which is right next to the castle. I never knew that. I never realized that. It's right there. I mean, you just go around the corner, bam, there it is. But when you're a kid, it's like, oh, you know, you don't know where anything is. But as you get older and you have the map and you have the bigger picture, it all makes sense. But when you're young and a child, it doesn't make any sense. Unless, in the case of Glory, at 6 years old, she had the map and had the whole park figured out. Unlike I did at that age, just a lot smarter than me. But in the end, we have a calm assurance that if we could see like our Heavenly Father sees, if we could see what He saw, we would go, oh, that makes perfectly good sense. I see, oh, yeah, of course. But do you realize we're children? We're children. That's what the Bible calls us. We're children. We don't have the map. We just know the one who does. And not only does he have the map, he drew the map. And these realities, being convinced of them, is what changes the whole game in our trust factors. You know, this business about knowing the end from the beginning, it's even in his name. Look at Revelation 22. Behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me, to render to every man according to what he has done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, what? The beginning and the end. He knows the end from the beginning. Why is that? Because he is the beginning and the end. Let me say that again. He knows the end from the beginning because he is the beginning and the end. Job 36:26, how great is our God beyond our understanding. Romans 11:23, oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments. Anybody that has the whole picture of this world, how unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways. And the whole point of tonight is this, is that along with the Israelites in Isaiah 46, the thing that is going to cause us to stop not trusting God and starting to run off to all this other stuff is this reality. Of all the things you know about God, so many wonderful things to be drawn to, the thing that God impressed on those people was this: I have my purposes, I will accomplish my purposes, I know the end from the beginning, and I can do whatever I want. That alone, that conviction is what drives away the faithless, sinful, disastrous things in our lives. I hope you get that. God's provision, you know, is not always physical. It's certainly spiritual. Sometimes it's even psychological and behavioral. And for our benefit, knowing that as you respond in life in a godly way, you know, God brings blessings in your life. How are you going to do that? I want to go back to my brother as I wrap this up. We had planted the key in Andrew's pocket, and I wasn't there when he found it. I wished I had been. But the way I understood it was that Andrew, when he did find the key, he immediately went to Jonathan, who he had accused of having the key, or at least being one of the last ones with the key. Now, Andrew didn't know a game was being played, but it became very quickly, it was in Andrew's understanding that I made a mistake. And so he went straight to Jonathan, ran upstairs, and went straight to Jonathan and profusely apologized to him. Asked his forgiveness. Remember, in my family, it's all, some of this is all in playfulness, but there was a sincerity to it, I'm sure. So I was interested in that, and my mother told me, she said that Andrew, who actually was the one who had the key, was sitting there watching all this when Andrew came in to speak to his brother and made all this apology. And Andrew, kind of under his breath, my mom heard it, said, "This is a memorable moment." So I called Andrew. I said, "I want to know what was going on in your head. Why was that a memorable moment?" He said, "Well, first of all, it's because sometimes you can construct something in your mind that isn't real, and I was kind of watching it happen." But then the more we talked, he said, "I was impressed that Uncle Andrew so quickly went to Jonathan and apologized when he was clearly wrong." I said, "I wondered about that." So I called Jonathan. I said, "Jonathan, I wasn't there, but I heard he came and profusely apologized to you." And Jonathan told me to... told me when I asked him, he says, "Yeah, and he even got down on his knee." He said, "I was enjoying every second of it." So I said, "John, how did that impact you?" He said, "Oh, a lot." This is basically his quote. He said, "I mean, here is somebody you look up to and respect, and he is quickly making it right and even asking for forgiveness. He could have just laughed it off and avoided it, but he didn't." The more I thought about that, I thought, you know, that whole key thing, which is such a bothersome thing at times, because we've only got one of them, we got to protect it, and, you know, if Papa didn't, Dad didn't do that, we'd lose the key and be paying $50 every week. And that was, you know, all that stuff that went on, as I look back at it, two young men in very impressionable times of their life, determining the attitudes and the actions they're going to have towards people in the future and even their own wives and their children, got a living example of what you're supposed to do when you mess up. And it was in full color. And I asked Jonathan, I said, "Do you think that's going to affect you the rest of your life?" He said, "Absolutely." So, providentially, a key was lost. Providentially, a joke was played. And God accomplished something that will possibly, we don't know, but possibly, potentially, create the ability to relate to other people in a powerful way that's going to make an impact on generations to come, because there was a dramatic moment and an impressionable year, and I can see Andrew and Jonathan and now all the family that's heard about all this. In that flash of a moment when you've made a mistake and you messed up and you even pressed it and now you've realized you're wrong, you got a decision to make. Am I going to kind of just get out of it, or am I going to go back and say, "You know what, I was wrong. I am so sorry. Please forgive me." At least the help is there for that to happen because of a difficult circumstance. Who knows? Maybe it was a test for Andrew. I don't know. But I'm glad he passed it. And I'm glad that God works providentially in our lives. And I'm glad that we even think that way, because we have a God who is that way. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your providential guidance and concern and care for our lives. We thank you that you are in charge of our lives. We thank you that we can look through the lens of providence at the whole world. And we can be drawn to you because of this powerful reality in you, that would cause us to leave the gods of the world. That this is what should impress us. This is what should drive us. This is what should draw us into faith and trust. That you can do, and you do, whatever you purpose, whatever your pleasure, this is what you do. Let it be applied to all of our lives. Help us to work through our difficulties, our situations, with this in view, knowing that you are at work and you're doing something and you're bringing purpose, you're bringing meaning and satisfaction to everything we experience. We trust you for the results of this message in the name of Jesus. Amen.